welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're almost through the first month of 2024, and it's only going to get worse, folks. It's time to act, and that's why I keep saying, what's it going to take? But we've got Paul Venable back with us, and Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
And actually, so I started diving into the amendments that were already proposed to the Articles of Confederation. In other words, the states had already tried to pass amendments, or at least at the very beginning here, because the ones that I basically shared with you, at least the first one I shared with the audience, was one that was submitted before the Articles of Confederation was fully ratified. So in other words, they already started realizing that there were some problems. And so this next one was, and you got to remember that they ratified the Articles of Confederation in the month of March. I think it was just before this amendment, which means, because nothing happens quickly back in those days, not that they couldn't get work done. Amazingly, they were able to do work pretty quick. I just doubt that they were able to publish this amendment by the Continental Congress prior to, because, you know, it takes a little while for everybody to, you know, agree and then sign off on something. So this had to have been in the works. They probably already had a committee to go off and kind of create this amendment before the Constitution or the Articles of Confederation, that current Constitution that they had, hadn't been ratified. So as we look at this document and the title, Amendment to Give Congress Coercive Power Over the States and Their Citizens.
Whose idea was that?
Well, so the reality is that Congress had no power.
Okay.
And even though there were things in the Articles of Federation, they had no ability to actually extract the pound of flesh that they needed so badly to pay debts and what have you. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, this is pretty revealing, because they go through here in this amendment, and we're going to read this, but they actually point out, you know, hey, you guys all agreed that you were going to comply with these things in the Articles of Confederation, and you're not. And so, you know, we can't exist on honor. It's like, folks, it's like going down to the grocery store. How nice would it be to just be able to say, well, I don't have the money on me, but I'll pay you later, and just walk out with all your groceries. You know,
right.
In today's fashion, there's a saying, you know, why don't you go down with, you know, with that honor, that feeling you have, and get a dozen of eggs and see how many eggs you can get with that. Because you can't get anything today if you don't have the money. And they were basically suffering in the same manner. And they basically said, we have to have an ability to actually, you know, force you to pay, force you to do the things that we're supposed to be doing for you. Which is one of the reasons why, when they walked into the Constitutional Convention, they realized that they needed to have some real constraints on the ability for the federal government to usurp or to take on anything other than what was granted.
Okay.
So, in other words, can you, you know, let's, and because we, I just got the Commerce Clause, or not the Commerce Clause, the petition clarifying that the Commerce Department is unconstitutional. The federal government cannot regulate commerce within the states. And they can't just permanently regulate commerce between the states. In other words, it's not their job to actually be the traffic cop of all commerce. Their job was to, basically the word regulate means to put in good order. Back in those days, that was the primary definition of regulate, to put in good order. And the intent as it was sold by, you know, the framers during the ratification debates, is that the Commerce Clause strictly gave the federal government the ability to become the peacekeeper between the states to ensure that the states treated each other fairly and equally, that they didn't, you know, start engaging in economic warfare, because they were divided. I mean, the abolition movement and slavery, I mean, they were really divided. You know, in today's aspects, there's hardly any division between the states today.
Right.
I mean, if there's any division between the states, it is more of a bias, you know, oh, well, you happen to live in the South where that's where slavery used to be, but it's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, why even bring it up? My point is that, you know, sometimes we cling on to things because of history or what have you, but that doesn't make us better off. You know, the concept of forgiving, forgetting, and moving on. You know, a friend of mine used to always tell me that the definition, the old definition of forgiveness, is to give as before. In other words, if you truly forgive somebody, you will give unto them the way you would have before the transgression occurred.
Okay.
So so there you go. Okay. So if you really forgive somebody, you wouldn't be hesitant, or you wouldn't, be stingy with your giving of, you know, substance assistance or what have you.
Right.
And so anyway, I wanted to kind of give a good overview for this. And so go ahead and let's start off again. And as you read this, I'm sure that you'll have some questions or comments. So go ahead.
Okay. So we're starting at the beginning, right?
We are. Yeah. It is stipulated. Yep.
Okay. So whereas it is stipulated and declared in the 13th article of the Confederation, quote, that every state shall abide by the determinations of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this Confederation are submitted to them, and that the articles of this Confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state, end quote. By which article a general and implied power is vested in the United States and Congress assembled to enforce and carry into effect all the articles of the said Confederation against any of the states which shall refuse or neglect to abide by their determinations or shall otherwise violate any of the said articles. But no determinate and particular provision is made for that purpose. And whereas the want of such provision may be made a pretext to call into question the legality of measures which may be necessary for preserving the authority of the Confederation and for doing justice to the states which shall duly fulfill their federal engagements, and it is moreover most consonant to the spirit of a free Constitution that on the one hand all exercise of power shall be explicitly and precisely warranted, and on the other hand that the penal consequences of a violation of duty should be clearly promulgated and understood. And whereas it is further declared by the said 13th article of the Confederation that no addition shall be made to the articles thereof, unless the same shall be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state. The United States, in Congress assembled, having seriously and maturely deliberated on these considerations and being desirous as far as possible to cement and invigorate the federal union, that it may be both established on the most immutable basis and be the more effectual for securing the immediate object of it, do hereby agree to and recommend to the legislatures of every state to confirm and to authorize their delegates in Congress to subscribe the following clause as an additional article to the 13 Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union.
Okay, so any questions on, I mean, it's kind of straightforward. They're saying that, hey, you guys agreed, you're not abiding by this, so we need to add this clause to give us more power to get what we need.
So now, the other thing is, now, there really wasn't a way, you know, I was looking at your document, Why Counties Matter Most. And I just happened upon this paragraph, you know, that under the Articles, the states did not grant the power to the Continental Congress to amend the Constitution, right? And so what they're doing here is the Congress is using the only thing they have available is to create this, I guess, new article and send it to all the states for, guess what, their unanimous consent, right?
Yeah, in a way, it's written, whereas, like a resolution.
Right. Okay.
Or like a petition, But bottom line, they're basically saying this is what we need, because technically the states actually have to come to an agreement with what that language is.
Okay.
And in other words, the states, when you really look at the cumbersome process, the states, when there is going to be an amendment to the Articles of Confederation, the states really need to pull into, to do it effectively, they need to pull into a convention each time. Because if not, what happens is, just imagine, you've got 13 people that have to buy off and agree. And so every time somebody makes a change, it'll go to, you know, maybe a particular state like Rhode Island, or maybe a lot of states will want to make a lot of different changes. How effective is that if it's not done in a convention?
Right. And not only are they supposed to agree, they have to agree unanimously.
Unanimously. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that actually becomes one of the things that becomes the obvious point of why they had to make that change. Now, you can hear the opponents to the Article 5 convention, because, you know, you got the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. The anti-conventionites, you know, basically, you know, go down the path of saying, you know, hey, you know, they want to rewrite the Constitution, runaway Constitution. They make these assertions that that's obviously going to happen. Well, it will happen if you have a convention without any clear expectations. And in other words, when you read and look at the Articles, not the Articles of Confederation, when you're looking at the current day Convention of States, they have ideas that they want to beat around the bush, but they don't have any clear delineation. As a matter of fact, the real problem is that they're saying, let us meet to figure out what we can do regarding federal overreach. In other words, what can we do to the Constitution to deal with our subcontractor, the federal government, in holding them to the Constitution? What?
Right.
What? I mean, they're all yammering and flapping their gums that the federal government is not abiding by the Constitution. And we have to have a convention to amend the Constitution to deal with that. What?
Okay.
Are you kidding me? So, in other words, when you have a child and the child is directly violating the rules that you've laid down, then you have to have the parents, you know, because, I mean, 9 times out of 10, when you lay down rules, there's direct punishment that comes with that.
Right.
And so when the parents say, oh, well, our child is breaking our rules, we have to sit down and figure out what, you know, how we have to adjust our rules. No. You don't do that. No parent does that with their child. Make up new rules or anything like that. What a parent does is they actually inflict the consequences of violating the rules. And we have actually put into place in the Constitution, this is where, folks, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment gave us everything. When we have public servants doing things that they have no business doing, and they're violating their oath of office, they're violating the Constitution, then they're gone. The states need to start enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and getting rid of all of Congress for failing to deal with the invasion, getting rid of all of Congress for, you know, all of the things that they're not doing. I mean, they're basically attacking the United States and the citizens. They're conducting warfare tactics on the citizens of the United States with pure immunity. Anyway.
And it's warfare on every level. I mean, it's economic warfare. Mm-hmm. It is a real invasion. And on top of that, this is hard for me to say, but we've got people dying because of our either actions or inactions.
Right.
Okay, these are citizens of the United States.
Right.
And it's like we've been conditioned to be numb to it. Uh-huh. Well, I'm not, and I know you're not, but there needs to be an awakening. So I guess next paragraph, right?
Right, go ahead.
Okay, it is understood and hereby declared that in case any one or more of the Confederated States shall refuse or neglect to abide by the determinations of the United States and Congress assembled, or to observe all the articles of the Confederation as required by the 13th article, the said United States and Congress assembled are fully authorized to employ the force of the United States as well by sea as by land to compel such state or states to fulfill their federal engagements, and particularly to make distinct on any of the effects, vessels, and merchandises of such state or states or of any of the citizens thereof, wherever found, and to prohibit and prevent their trade and intercourse as well with any other of the United States and the citizens thereof as with any foreign state, and as well by land as by sea, until full compensation or compliance be obtained with respect to all requisitions made by the United States and Congress assembled in pursuance of the Articles of Confederation. You know.
Yes.
So, you know, this is part of the, when you said that this was shortly after the Articles of Confederation,
uh-huh.
Its weaknesses were so obvious that they had to come up with something like this to get it to work.
Well, so actually what this conveys, because remember, the Articles of Confederation were submitted for ratification in 1877. So that was basically 4 years in the hands of the states, as well as 4 years with Continental Congress trying to pay debts, trying to actually execute a war. I mean, at this point in time, we were, you know, coming to the end of the Revolutionary War, right? The treaty.
Right.
When was the Treaty of Paris signed? I mean, it was 1783, but what particular day? And you know, March. It's still kind of early in the year, so I'm gonna guess, because back in those days they didn't do a lot of warfare fighting during the wintertime.
Right.
You know, hence George Washington and winter's quarters, you know, where there was a pause on the war because it was just unfit for humans to be able to go out and fight when it's freezing and snowing and so forth. I mean, they tried a little bit, but they realized that, you know, it's better to just, you know, kind of hunker down. So anyway.
That's probably why George Washington's defeat of the Hessians was such a shocking surprise.
Right.
You know, on when he crossed the Delaware. Okay, right. Where am I? Next paragraph?
Yes.
It's really short. Okay, just a sentence, actually. And it is to be understood and is hereby agreed and conceded that this article shall be fully and absolutely binding and conclusive when all the states not actually in the possession of the enemy shall enact the same.
So it means what it says, and we mean to do what we're supposed to do, kind of thing. So,
right,
it's an indictment. Again, this really shows how the states, you know, were really putting lipstick on a pig and calling themselves a union, but not behaving as a part of that union. Mm-hmm. And so that sentiment was really starting to, I'll just say, prevail more and more and more as time went from here, 1781, 6 years later, going into the Constitutional Convention. They all understood that they needed to create a central government that had, you know, the ultimate power to do what it needed to, what it was charged to do. Now, don't think for a minute that these men basically said, oh, well, you know what? We're going to give it so much power that it can do whatever it really wants to do.
That's not what they want.
That is not what they wanted. As a matter of fact, that's why they designed the Constitution very specifically with enumerated powers, and they spelled it out. And so really, because having done the petition for the Commerce Department under the Commerce Clause, we also finished the petition for the Department of Interior. And to be clear, you know, most people think that, you know, the federal government can come in and basically, you know, declare all of this land federal property, federal lands. The word federal lands is so ambiguous that, you know, the framers were very, very clear regarding land. As a matter of fact, during the Virginia ratification debates, they talked about that. They understood that the, you know, the state or a monarch or any government that possesses unlimited amount of land, then they have unlimited wealth.
Right.
And the design of this federal government was not to establish a wealthy government, to establish a government with the energy to secure the sovereignty of the wealthy states that had all their land. In other words, it was a contradiction to say that you, state, are sovereign over all of this land within your border, and then come for the federal government to be able to come in and go, oh, well, we're going to take some of this land from you. We're taking all this land from you.
Right.
This is why it was enumerated in the Constitution, the purposes of the land for the erection of forts, magazines, shipyards, and for needful buildings. And the needful buildings was to be able to do what they needed to do. And I, you know, so people go, well, what is that? What's a needful building? Well, they had a responsibility of maintaining and basically putting tariffs or taxes, imposts on stuff that were coming into the United States, which means that they needed to have a presence in every port where international trade was coming in. So as you look, as you know, because international trade was coming into the Mississippi, international trade was coming into, you know, all the seaports, you know, along the eastern seaboard. And as we expand to the west, they needed to have, you know, federal marshals, because that's what they ended up doing. They hired marshals to basically make sure that, and it, they were called marshals, but a lot of them didn't even carry guns, because they were there really working for the Department of Treasury, making sure that the imposts were being paid on the goods coming in. And so, and how they figured all that out, you know, Hamilton was, you know, a genius in a lot of those things. Or actually, come to find out, maybe he wasn't a genius. Maybe, you know, it was had more to do with his tutelage from the British Crown, because he was an alleged spy. But anyway, so they needed to have a building in every port facility. They needed to have at least a building to house their federal, you know, responsibility of maintaining and keeping track of all of these imposts. And did they collect the impost as soon as it landed? Or did they collect that impost to its destination? So in other words, if the stuff came in and it was raw goods, and those raw goods were going to be basically used for manufacturing something, so that when the manufacturers sold their goods, you know, at what point did they do that? And so they had to figure all that out, but they had to have needful buildings for these employees that had these responsibilities. That's why they had needful buildings. So we're going to go into a break, folks. But to get back to what I was saying, the framers created an enumerated constitution that truly specified why and how the federal government and the way they were to function. I mean, it was all broken down very neatly. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now that we finished that one, the next one that we need to read is the third, and this is actually the committee report on carrying the Confederation into effect and on additional powers needed by Congress. Now, this was done August 22nd, but again, it's the committee report on carrying the Confederation. And so do you
okay,
have...
Okay, and I've got it.
Okay, you got that
yeah,
one?
I've got it.
Okay, so this is a little lengthy, but here they're actually... Now, again, this is an amendment, and look at all the stuff that they're looking to, you know, try to get embedded or into the Articles of Confederation. So go ahead. Go ahead and let's start with this.
Okay. Committee report on carrying the Confederation into effect and on additional powers needed by Congress. This is the 22nd of August, 1781. The committee appointed to prepare an exposition of the Confederation, a plan for its complete execution and supplemental articles report. That they ought to be discharged from the exposition of the Confederation because such a comment would be voluminous if coextensive with the subject, the omission to enumerate any congressional powers become an argument against their existence, and it will be early enough to insist upon them when they shall be exercised and disputed. Now, I'm reading this out loud, and if I were reading this not out loud, I would have to read it again.
Okay.
Okay. Just because of the way the language is used, you know, in fact, GR, if you don't mind, I am going to read it again because I haven't been able to wrap my head around it. Maybe you can.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right. That they ought to be. Now, so let's see. Congress appointed to prepare an exposition of the Confederation, a plan for its complete execution and supplemental articles report. That they ought to be discharged from the exposition of the Confederation.
Now because, that they
yeah so, let's take this
so that they that is the Continental Congress. That Continental Congress ought to be discharged from the exposition of the Confederation because such a comment would be voluminous if coextensive with the subject the omission to enumerate any congressional powers become an argument against its existence. And it, so, in other words, they're looking at the fact that they're basically doing their job, and every time they do their job, they feel like it becomes one of those arguments against what they're doing, or the fact that why are they doing this?
Right.
Right.
Okay. All right. When they shall be exercised and disputed. They further report that the Confederation requires execution in the following manner. One, by adjusting the mode and proportions of the militia to be furnished to a sister state laboring under invasion.
Okay, two, so what that means is that they're looking to make sure that they can supplement a state under invasion from their sister states, you know, pulling up and federalizing the militia to move into that state. Kind of like what should be happening along the border.
So you're aware of what's happening along the border.
Yes.
Texas is defying Biden, and 24 states are supporting it.
Okay, so this is what Texas this is what Texas should have done in the 1990s.
Right.
And this is what Texas should have done in the early 2000s, 2010s. So we're three decades late, you know, and in between, what they did was they further exacerbated the problem by busing illegals, and they allowed the federal government to transship these invaders throughout the United States. They should not have allowed the federal government the ability to, you know, move these folks anywhere. They should have actually said, you know what, if you can't keep them, then put them back. Because bottom line, what does the Constitution say? The federal government, when facing an invasion, they're supposed to do one thing and one thing alone.
To call forth the militia.
Well, that
execute the laws of the Union. Suppress insurrections and repel invasions.
Repel invasions. That's the thing that they have to do. They have to repel it. So this actually, so this kind of comes up. And this actually came up in a conversation on social media where, you know, I provided the Naturalization Act of 1790, which basically laid out that, you know, for a person to be considered a natural born citizen, they have to be born by two citizens. In other words, it says right there that, you know, any person born, and it talks about even if these citizens are traveling abroad, if they're in another nation and these two U.S. citizens have a child, that child is a U.S. citizen.
Right.
In other words, it extends all persons born to U.S. citizens. If they are born in the United States or outside of the United States, they are considered a natural born citizen. Mm-hmm. Now, basically, this is a Republican that's come up and said this. He said, oh, well, you know, anybody that's born in the United States to illegals, then, or so somebody that's here that's not a citizen, they become a citizen. I go, are you kidding me?
And how did they come up with that?
Because of the, and I believe this goes back to the 1960s, it was the Brennan Court, and it was the concept of the anchor baby. And I believe if you look it up, folks, this was a case where the Supreme Court ruled that a child born to a Chinese citizen here in the United States was a U.S. citizen, even though the parents were not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. In other words, we now create a law that says that child can't leave the United States, but the parents have to. So this was the first leap in this progressive, you know, agenda. No other nation has a law like this. None at all. And as a matter of fact, the constitutional rights are extended to who? That's a question.
The constitutional rights are extended to citizens of the United States.
So are you telling me that a foreigner is not entitled to the protections of the Constitution?
You're correct.
That is right. Which means that because under the premise of these progressives that had extended, because they've actually made this this crazy bat crap crazy. There we go. I got to get back to using that term. Bat crap crazy ruling that foreigners or illegals or invaders are entitled to subsistence, welfare, or anything else that's out there.
They are not.
And they're not. So, as we kind of, you know, look at, you know, what's going on, we got to keep context, folks, that the process of the federal government is to basically ensure that, you know, there are providing this protection as well as the services that they're on the hook for, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So yep. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. So, okay, I did. No, I did number one, right?
You just did number one, correct. So number two.
Okay. Number two, by describing the privileges and immunities to which the citizens of one state are entitled in another, by setting forth the conditions, three, by setting forth the conditions upon which a criminal is to be delivered up by one state upon the demand of the executive of another, four, by declaring the method of exemplifying records and the operation of the acts and judicial proceedings of the courts of one state contravening those of the states in which they are asserted. Five, by a form to be observed in the notification of the appointment or suspension of delegates. Six, by an oath to be taken by every delegate against secret trusts and salaries. Seven, by specifying the privileges of delegates from arrests, imprisonment, questioning for free speech and debates in Congress, stating as well their answerability to their constituents as protesting against the authority of individual legislatures to absolve them from obligations to secrecy. I lost my...
So I'll do it. So, okay, got it. Go ahead.
You know, let me run across them. You know what this sounds like?
Uh-huh.
It sounds like these are things they're saying, these are things we need to do. So it wasn't in the articles, but already, you know, they hadn't been ratified for even 6 months. And they're already pointing out things which are familiar to me that have been put into the Constitution. Okay. So, right. So going on to eight.
Uh-huh.
By instituting an oath to be taken by the officers of the U.S. or any of them against presence, emoluments, office, or title of any kind from a king, prince, or foreign state. So you're saying that this wasn't in the articles?
That is correct.
Of course
yeah.
not.
Okay.
Okay. By one universal plan of equipping, training, and governing the militia. That was nine. It is ten. By a scheme for estimating the value of all land within each state granted to or surveyed for any person or persons together with the buildings and improvements thereon, and the apportionment of certain periods at which payment shall be made. 11, by establishing rules for captures on land and the distribution of the sales.
So, so let me go back. Okay. So the way they did taxation, they taxed based on apportionment or however they, you know, declared the value of the land, because you can see that they had an assessor. And that's how they laid taxes, based on the value of land. Mm-hmm. Right? Is that not what you're seeing there? And,
well, yeah.
And so when they basically went from the Articles of Confederation to the article or to the Constitution, the federal government had the ability to lay three types of taxes: impost, on which means taxation on imports coming into the United States. And then there are duties, which is the direct tax that they place on states based on apportionment. We need this much money based on how many people you have, not based on property. Mm-hmm. So the need for the assessment of property value, I think, kind of went away. And then the other tax that they had, which was enumerated, are excise tax. Now, the mm-hmm. duty tax went away, and it was transmuted into an income tax. And so instead of taxing the increasing value of your property, they said, mm-hmm. we're going to now tax on the money that you make. And okay. Let me ask you, do you think it's more reasonable for government to tax on income than it is on your existing property? The fact that you have property, whether you made money or not, we're going to tax it.
I don't think it's reasonable to tax on income.
You don't think it's reasonable or unreasonable to tax income?
I think it's unreasonable to tax income.
Okay, so to be clear, if they can tax property, then they can take property.
Correct.
In other words, if you're unable to pay your taxes, then what do they do? And I believe that violates the essence of government. Government's responsibility is to protect life and private property. As soon as they create this link to taxing property, they then have the ability to take it. And that means that they're no longer engaged in protecting it.
That's correct. Is my income also my property?
Well, so your income is what you've gained. In other words, you went out and you made money. So in other words, I get the fact that they're taxing your productivity, right? I get that. But it's far better to, because let's say you weren't productive for a year or two. Mm-hmm. That means that they get no money from you.
But when you say productive, and this may be, we've been sharing things for a long time. We may disagree here because I don't believe that it's necessarily a gain. I'm trading my time for what they've given me, okay? Which means it's almost, it's I'd consider it an even exchange.
Well, so it's like a sales tax, right? It's a transaction.
Okay.
A sales tax. A sales tax is a tax on transactions, right?
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
So that's all they're doing is they're, if you look at income, as a sales tax, because you're right. There is a comp. Now they only tax your actual compensation. In other words, your pay, not your full compensation. In other words, let's say your employer pays for your health care, pays for, you know, dental and all of these other benefits, and they got a retirement plan and everything else. Does that mean that, with, you know, because that's a part of the transaction, right? Are you not receiving these benefits? They don't tax the entire compensation. They're only taxing what you're receiving. As far as the financial, you know, hand to hand, we're giving you this money, but we're also covering these other things for you.
Well, they're covering these other things, and I actually think, let me see if I remember correctly. They actually don't tax. Actually, the way they put it is they defer the tax, for example, on your retirement or on your health care. And so I guess
the health care is not taxed at all because you can have health savings accounts and all that money pre-tax goes into that account. And as long as it goes,
right. It
is not taxed.
No, you're correct.
Okay. So there
are so it sounds like, you know, what happens is, I think what bothers me is the abuse of it. So, for example, okay, we have, it's not uniform, and because it's not uniform, because it's not treated uniformly, I think that's part of our economic problem.
Yeah, so the states at the very onset of the new government under the U.S. Constitution, the states were driven to create a taxation on property. And I think my feeling on that is that's not good, because then it empowers the state to take your property.
Right. And correct. It does.
And so right. I don't believe a person should be kicked off their property because they can't pay taxes. Because if they can tax you every year on the value of that property, they can end up basically taxing you out of your residence.
But what you share here, what we discovered here is that property tax is, we have a precedent for property tax. In other words, they had to find some way to tax. Now, going back to the income tax, okay, at one point we didn't have the income tax. Didn't the Congress have the funding to fulfill its enumerated powers without the income tax?
Well, so the reason the income tax came along, was because the federal government was spending more and more money on things they had no constitutional authority to spend on. And as a matter of fact, this goes all the way back to the beginning of the federal government opening up the federal purse in the 1820s after the Republicans you know, this, I'll just say the limited government Republicans from Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, after they, because these guys were very fiscally tight. Mm-hmm. They weren't, you know, apt to just go spend money. But it was with John Quincy Adams, who, you know, kind of, you know, grew up in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, who, you know, had this, you know, they had a paradigm of sharing and, you know, for the good of the good of all, because it was, I think, John Quincy Adams that actually looked favorably upon assisting the railroad companies. And then down the road, John Quincy Adams was replaced by big government Jackson, who had, you know, even less reservations of, you know, spending money on stuff. And I find it interesting that at least he followed suit with Madison and Monroe regarding the Department of Transportation or the funding for those purposes of being able to create this permanent tax. Anyway, so my point is that because they started spending and they quickly started making this association that, you know what, we'll just spend, we'll give the states the money to go do this, we'll do that. They didn't have the authority to do that.
Right.
They didn't have the authority to do general good for the states.
So what I'm getting back to now is we wound up with an income tax because Congress was spending outside of its authority. I think you just said that.
Yes.
It was spending so much money. So now they're trying to figure out a way to get more money, and they figured it out. Okay. And I'm okay. I think we were on 11.
Well, I don't want to move forward yet. When we look at the duty tax, because the Constitution gave the federal government the ability to create a duty tax, that duty tax was transformed into an income tax.
Okay.
Now, here's the question. You know, when we look at what our federal government is doing, we have to actually do the assessment to say, should we actually get rid of the duty tax? Because we now have a federal government that is so ultimately, if America actually fulfilled its divine order in spreading liberty throughout the world, and, you know, because if you really look at it, when we started going into the late 1800s, after slavery, there was no reason why the U.S. Constitution and states throughout the world didn't actually become one territories and then become incorporated, you know, or integrated. I don't want to use incorporated because of the Organic Act, but became integrated into the United States so that, you know, where would we be today if the majority of South America and good parts of Africa and even parts of Europe were, and maybe even some places in Asia were now becoming a part of the United States? Where would we?
It would be a very different world.
It would be, right? Because I don't believe we would have had as much warfare at all. Mm-hmm. Since the Civil War, has there been any, you know, literally deadly force warfare inflicted from one state to another within the United States?
No.
No, but since the advent of the League of Nations and the United Nations, has not war continually broken out?
It's never, it's essentially hasn't ceased.
Okay, because what is the greatest cost to a government and a nation? Is it the taxation? Absolutely. War is a greater cost than we can even fathom because it's the loss of human capital by deadly force. I mean, we're literally killing people. And so why are we still constraining the world from being able to become a part of this union?
Because somebody, GR, is getting rich from war.
a lot of people, Raytheon, you know, Boeing, there's lots of companies in America and throughout the world, BAE Systems, they make money in having a war machine. I truly believe that, you know, the money that we're spending on national or world defense by this point in time, the money that we're spending on world defense would be nothing. I mean, because the threats would basically have been resolved.
Yeah. Resolved is a good word. Okay.
Where we may like still that. Have some big nations like China, you know, and or Russia, where, you know, these Bolshevik revolutions were successful, you know, because Russia created this problem when the Tsar emancipated everybody. That was a problem. He didn't see through things because they had 22 million slaves and serfs in Russia. Right. 22 million. He basically took, you know, all the labor force throughout all of Russia and said, you don't have to, you know, be a laborer anymore. And that because they were just as baked into their slavery and serfdom just as the South was, and it became a real problem. But in the South, we had this, you know, I'll just say this healthy North labor situation where, you know, we could actually assist in, one, the recovery, reconstruction, and, you know, getting this nation back up on its feet, right?
Well, you know, now here's a dumb question. What he must – the Tsar must have think thought he was doing something moral, okay?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
He must have believed that he was doing the right thing by freeing the slaves, but there was no foresight. In other words, he just turned loose, 22 million people
Right, and in Britain, they did the same thing in the 1860s. They emancipated slaves, but Britain gave a pound for every slave that was freed to the shop owner or whatever, so that they could turn around and start paying for labor. So they kickstarted their economy by paying those who lost the laborers to say, okay, now you have to pay for it because they're no longer a slave. So they transitioned into an economy of transactions instead of force and coercion. Does that make sense?
Right.
Okay.
Yes, it does make sense.
And so, but see, they solved their problem pretty quickly, where Russia, the Tsar, basically kept all of his opulence and those who had, they kept, which prepared the world, or I should say their little world, for a communist revolution, for the Bolshevik revolution to basically implement, take from those who have and give to those who have not. In other words, communism, the recipe for it was just, it just literally spilled onto the Russian plains. We're out of time, so we'll be back tomorrow, and we'll maybe pick this up before we go back into this. But I wanted to explore this because there's lots of people that talk about taxation as theft, and it's not. But we have to figure out what is the most palatable, you know, what can we actually accept in our lives for taxation, because government needs to exist. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.